Now we're on, yep. Thanks. We're back on the record. We're calling docket number FIC 2023-0338. Michael Spilo versus Chair of Central Middle School Building Committee, Greenwich Public Schools et al.
Chairman, I have a procedural question if I can ask. I don't know. It's Commissioner Fusashi.
Yes, Commissioner
The Spilo case and the Reeler case, while they're not on the same legal point, they deal with the same, some same. So when do we consider the amicus brief of in the Arroyo case? When does that fall? And I know that Spilo case comes first now, then the Arroyo case, and the amicus brief is addressed to the Arroyo case. It also deals with education, boards of education. Do we have to consider letting them do the amicus brief, automatically do the amicus brief, and where they come in the order? I've read the amicus brief.
I would recommend taking up the amicus brief in the case in which it was requested consideration, which would be 2023-0356.
So last case.
It pertains to that case.
And vote in the order in the cases are?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, thank you for that.
Thank you. Counsel, will you identify yourself for the record?
Good afternoon. Attorney Andrew McPherson of the law firm of Goldstein and Peck for the respondents.
Thank you. Is there anyone here? You represent the Central Middle School, is that correct?
The Central Middle School Building Committee in Greenwich Public Schools.
Is Michael Spilo here? Is there anyone here representing Michael Spilo? Counsel, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. We'll be very brief. Attorney Hyde did a very good job in setting forth the facts as to what was testified to. and for the most part, the facts are uncontested. There is an issue. What happened was there was a meeting on June 13th, 2023. It was a hybrid meeting. Part of it was via Zoom and part of it was in person. So while the individuals in the meeting, both in person and online, were present. Mr. Turner, who's the chairman of the committee at issue, held a vote to go into executive session. And while members of the public were still present, now there is an issue of fact as to how many members, but there's no issue of fact as to two members of the public who are not members of the committee were present. And he held a vote to seat those two non-members into executive session. Now, Mr. Turner, the chairman, had the authority under the Freedom of Information Act to seat those members without holding a vote. He did not. There was no requirement that he hold a vote to have those two members sit during the executive session. in essence, he could have asked the other members of the committee, is everybody ready for these two individuals to come into the executive session? And they said yes. And that's the same thing as holding a vote, which is what he did. So the respondents ask that this commission change paragraph 17, in which Attorney Hyde concluded the respondents committed a technical violation of section 1-200 subsection 6 of the general statutes by voting during the executive session. And again, it's because the vote was superfluous. There was no requirement that the vote happened. It could have been, is everybody ready for these non-members to come in? And the other issue, as I...
Which paragraph is that again?
17.
Thank you.
And the other issue in which there was a finding, Attorney Hyde correctly stated in the facts that the two non-members, one of which was a liaison, she's a member of the Greenwich First Selectmen Advisory Committee for People with Disabilities. And she has a liaison type position to the committee because the committee's sole issue on June 13, 2023 was the construction project of a school. And she her presence was requested because of her expertise with the ADA and the fact that she is a advisory committee member for the people with disabilities. And the other non-member who was present was the actual principal of the school. And Chairman Turner, as he does with all these executive sessions, make sure that they only deal with one single issue. And the single issue here was about the progress of the construction of the school in which Mr. Healy is the principal. And as a result, Mr. Healy was asked to attend, and he did attend the entire executive session. Attorney Hyde is correct in his finding, and the same with Ms. Cowley. Other than that, I just rely on my brief I submitted, unless there's any questions.
Thank you. Do any of the commissioners have any questions? Attorney. Oh, yes.
I just
Attorney, Commissioner Street.
I was just going to ask a quick question of the hearing officer.
Attorney Hyde.
Attorney Hyde, the hearing officer in this matter?
Yeah, so it was obviously a technical violation. Sometimes we've had it where we, you know, said that there's no order. Sometimes there is an order. Was this something that you feel confident just to, you know, strictly comply with it, but it was a technical, it sounded like to what the respondent was mentioning?
Yeah, with respect to paragraph 17, you'll notice in the order doesn't make any mention of that because it was a technical violation. And Attorney McPherson's representation of the facts is accurate.
So it's only the previous violation that's being held there.
Correct. I just want to make note. I just made note of the fact that you cannot vote in executive session. That's what happened. Yeah.
So really the basis is just the paragraph 11 violation. I see that now because you would have written comply with section this and the other section, I guess. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Do any of the other commissioners have any questions? Do you wish to say anything else, counsel?
No, thank you.
I entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, I move adoption of the bill.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Fusashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Goldsby Wells?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously.
Thank you for your time.
I'll just state for the record, Mr. Chairman, that Commissioner Farish did have to leave, so that's why she's not recorded on that vote.
Thank you.
Will not be recorded on any subsequent votes.
Thank you. All right. So we're moving on to docket number FIC 2023-0356, Juan Ariola, Diane Gagnon, and John Russell versus Chair, Board of Education, Hampton Public Schools, and now.
Yes, would you like to come forward, please, sir?
Yes, thank you.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Juan Lucio Ariola.
Thank you, Mr. Ariola.
Good afternoon, Attorney Abby Booth from Chipman and Goodwin on behalf of the Respondent Board of Education.
Thank you.
Attorney Thomas Mooney here on behalf of either Cave and Caps and or the Hampton Board of Education. I filed an appearance in both. May I speak briefly to the pending motion?
Yes.
My colleague and I have talked about it. We understand and we appreciate the fact that here you are late on an afternoon. And we're the last up. So what we would propose relative to the motion is that my colleague, Attorney Booth, will speak to the specifics of the Hampton case. And I will speak to the more global concerns that both the CAPS and CABE have concerning this decision. And we will divide our 10 minutes and not prolong the hearing unnecessarily.
And you'll be addressing your issues set forth in your amicus curiae?
Correct.
Attorney Murphy?
I think that's somewhat in keeping what I was going to recommend. Somebody requesting an amicus Well, first off, the hearing officer did accept a brief already on this matter. And as you know, amicus isn't permitted to argue unless there's special permission granted. My thought was to recommend that you allow argument from the amicus, but just with regard to matters that are not addressed by the council representing the schools, and second, that it be up to 5 minutes. So I think that's a better deal if we just do 10 minutes total. So I would support what has been recommended by Attorney Mooney.
Do we need a motion with regard to the?
I think so, yes. So,
I'd entertain a motion with regard to the amicus curiae brief and Attorney Mooney.
Would that be a motion to allow the brief into the record?
No, motion to allow oral argument to be split equally with counsel for the Hampton Public Schools and only addressing arguments that are not addressed by
Mr. Chairman, I move that.
Commissioner Hank is second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion?
Commissioner Hank, just that Attorney Mooney has already parsed it out, you know, prior to divide it. So I'm certainly fine with that.
It's Commissioner Fusashi. I think there's some really interesting issues raised here. So I will not obstruct the feelings of the group, but I would not personally be too tight on the time.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call with regard to the argument concerning the amicus curiae brief. Commissioner Fusashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Goldsby Wells?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Eben, yes. Passes unanimously. All right, so we'll allow that. So, sir, do you understand what just happened? Mr. Oyola?
You just kind of granted everybody 10 minutes?
Well, they're dividing the 10 minutes that would normally be given to the respondents.
Okay.
So they're going to divide it between two of them, okay?
All right. You've got your 10.
You're going to get your 10. And they're most aggrieved, so I'm going to let you begin, if you'd like to begin, counsel, which means they lost, so they get to go first.
Thank you.
All right, go ahead. Counsel, just identify yourself for the record.
Of course, good afternoon. Attorney Abby Booth on behalf of the respondents. The sole question in this matter is whether the respondent Board of Education superintendent, its chief executive officer, improperly attended the board's executive session because her attendance was not limited to the period of time for which it was necessary to present testimony or opinion. I just want to note as a first matter that the respondents do not disagree with the hearing officer's facts as they're proposed in the decision, but just the conclusion that she comes to. As written, the proposed decision would impose an unworkable and unreasonable burden on boards of education to determine ad hoc during any executive session when its superintendent can remain or must leave that executive session. In the role of Chief Executive Officer of the Board of Education, in accordance with General Statute 10-157, a superintendent must have an opportunity to offer testimony or opinion on matters under consideration of the board. As such, the respondents request that the commission modify the proposed decision to find that the respondents did not violate 1-231A. And the specific language in which the respondents request the proposed decision to be modified is set forth in our brief. And to reserve time, I won't go through each section unless the commissioners have a question. The facts in this case fully support the respondent's position. The complainants challenged the presence of the board's former superintendent, Samantha Sarley, in an executive session in which the board was discussing a pending CHRO matter. As established at the hearing and noted by the hearing officer, the superintendent had acted as the liaison between the board and the CHRO during the proceedings, along with insurance counsel, who was representing the board in that matter. Superintendent Sarley had been invited into two previous executive sessions to discuss the same pending complaint on April 26, 2023 and May 31st, 2023. And during both of those executive sessions, Superintendent Sarley provided testimony and opinion on the pending matter before the CHRO. On June 28th, 2023, the superintendent and insurance counsel were again invited into executive session, the sole purpose of which was to discuss the pending CHRO matter. The complainant objected to the superintendent's presence in such executive session, and insurance counsel advised the board that her attendance was appropriate. The superintendent was prepared to share her opinion and offer and answer any questions regarding the CHRO proceeding during the executive session, and she was prepared to clarify or correct any of the statements or facts reported by insurance counsel during such executive session, as she had been working with insurance counsel on the CHRO proceeding. And as established at the hearing on this matter, the insurance counsel ultimately took the lead in discussing the CHRO matter at that particular executive session. At the hearing, the superintendent testified her role in the CHRO proceedings and the importance of her knowledge of the board's position on pending litigation. And two board members, Chair Rose Bisson and Mary Ellen Donnelly, also expressed the same sentiment, testifying that they reasonably anticipated that the superintendent would have provided testimony or opinion during that executive session in June, as she had during the two previous executive sessions. Additionally, the board members further testified that the superintendent needs to confer with the board as to what she can relay to the CHRO during a matter that's pending before it. The facts show that the direct involvement of Superintendent Sarley in the CHRO matter here fully authorized her attendance in the executive session. As established at hearing, and as I previously stated, she was the liaison between the Board of Education and the CHRO for these proceedings. And given her direct involvement in the matter, the superintendent's presence was necessary so she could provide testimony or opinion to the board on an as-needed basis. If the superintendent had not been present during the executive session, she would not have been privy to the information that the board had discussed, and she would not have been able to effectively serve as the board's liaison to the CHRO. The proposed decision, as it's written without further elaboration, states that the superintendent's attendance at the executive session was not limited to the time in which she needed to offer testimony or opinion. But this leaves the board with no guidance as to whether and for how long a superintendent may be permitted to attend an executive session without violating the act. The board would have to be clairvoyant to know in advance whether or not additional testimony or opinion would be necessary during an executive session in which only one matter was being discussed, in which the superintendent was the liaison for the board on. If there was a misunderstanding on behalf of insurance counsel, or if insurance counsel had represented something incorrectly to the board, the superintendent would not have, if she had not been present, the board would have been deprived of the testimony or opinion of the superintendent to clarify that misunderstanding. One notes the finding in paragraph 9, as I previously stated, that the superintendent didn't end up providing any specific testimony or opinion. But would this have been different if she had simply said, "I agree"? If she had said, "I disagree with what the insurance counsel had presented to the board"? How much would she have to say to establish that her opinion or testimony was necessary to comply with 1-231? The commission has previously recognized that an individual may be present throughout an executive session when their presence is necessary so that they can offer their opinion regarding potential impacts of a discussion in an executive session, and that their attendance can be for the entirety of the executive session in case the board members or the members of the body have to ask additional questions to that individual. And I refer you to the brief for the two specific cases that I've cited that I've recognized that. And so again, just the same is true here. The superintendent had expertise on the CHRO proceeding, needed to be present in the executive session to provide the board members with her expertise on the matter. And I now defer to Attorney Mooney.
I would not repeat the excellent description of the concerns of the Hampton Board of Education, but on behalf of Cave and Caps, I'd like to talk more generally about the fundamental issues that this case raises. And just for the commission's background knowledge, it may be obvious, but CABE is the Connecticut Association of Boards of Education, representing the interests of boards of education who have a vital interest in complying with the Freedom of Information Law. CAPS is the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. They, too, have a vital interest in complying with the law. And we're here because this decision leaves us at sea as to what is or is not permitted And we'd like to start by referring to the role of the superintendent. And this is a unique circumstance. The superintendent, by statute, is the chief executive officer of the Board of Education. And interestingly, I just put the executive session, executive officer. We have here a question of when the executive officer can be in an executive session. The hearing officer correctly noted that the superintendent is not a member of the Board of Education, but the superintendent has a special statutory responsibility to serve as the chief executive officer. And let's think about boards of ed. Who serves on a board of ed? Citizen volunteers in a multi-million dollar complicated organization. Who helps those citizen volunteers figure it out? The superintendent. What topics are privileged to executive session? Personnel matters. Is that an executive responsibility or does the board supervise? Well, the statute's clear that the superintendent evaluates and supervises all staff. The board members have a policy function. They may have a quasi-judicial function. But the day-to-day operational issues are the responsibility of the superintendent. And when we look at the executive session privilege, we see the direct connection between the responsibilities of the superintendent and what may or may not be discussed in executive session, personnel matters. That's squarely within the role of the superintendent. Pending claims and litigation. The board is going to discuss, do we settle, do we not settle? And the opinion and testimony of the superintendent is directly related to that. Will this set a precedent for the future? The superintendent knows the operational issues of the school district. On a practical level, if we parse this out and say, the decision gives us absolutely no guidance. It simply offers the conclusion. And apparently one can infer, but one can't be certain, that it's because the superintendent didn't speak. I don't want to repeat the excellent point unnecessarily, but would it have been different if the superintendent said, I agree? All we know is that the hearing officer, after finding all the facts correctly, concluded that the superintendent's presence on a matter on which the superintendent was directly involved was not limited to the time her testimony or opinion would be required. So we're very concerned about this decision because both boards of ed and the superintendents have a statutory responsibility to comply with the law. And under this decision, we're put to the Hobson's choice of either depriving the citizen volunteers of the professional expertise of the superintendent on matters discussed in executive session, or risking that in hindsight, because a disaffected board member is going to bring a claim, and now we're here at the commission potentially facing a finding that there's a violation of the law. I'd like to end these brief remarks with reference to public policy, because ultimately that's what the law is all about. You're implementing public policy. It's critically important to note that your charge as the Freedom of Information Commission to promote transparency in governmental operations is completely unaffected if you agree with us and dismiss this case. No one disputes that this private conversation in executive session was appropriate. So if you affirm this decision, the public is not served. If you dismiss this complaint, the public is not served. This was a private conversation. So as a matter of public policy, why would you say, you can't have the benefit of your superintendent, your chief executive officer, in that executive session to listen and to talk and to offer opinion or testimony? As a matter of public policy, we're all here to comply with the law. The lack of guidance in this decision and the potential for further complaints in the future leaves us questioning, how do we interpret this provision 1-231A in terms of limiting. We're concerned that the decision of the hearing officer was overly restrictive and unworkable. And finally, as a policy matter, we favor informed governmental decision making. If this decision stands and boards of ed are challenged to exclude their superintendent from discussions of executive actions that are properly the subject of executive session, it may well impede informed governmental decision making, and there's no public policy that would support that action. So we very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to the commission on this, and we ask that the complaint either be dismissed pursuant to the recommendations of the Hampton Board of Education, or that the matter be remanded to the hearing officer so that we can develop a more thorough record in this matter for the commission's consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Moody. Sir, would you like to begin?
Thank you.
Just identify yourself, please.
Okay. Juan Arriola.
Thank you.
We would like to begin by thanking the hearing officer for relying on the governing statutes to reach your decision. The opposition is concerned with statewide repercussions and the superintendent's ability to provide expert testimony to board members. That has not been the case even on our own board. Prior to the superintendent whose attendance during the executive session is in question, our superintendents have left executive sessions after answering questions or providing opinions on executive session matters. They would also wait outside the session in their office or with members of the public and make themselves available in case we needed to call them in to answer questions. This has been the practice at our school for decades and has become even easier due to virtual attendance. Last year, our interim superintendent did not attend any executive sessions, though the subjects were among those listed by the attorneys. And this year, our new superintendent has been a part of two executive sessions and has left them when finished answering questions or providing information. The superintendent in this case is labeled the liaison. She was the respondent in the CHRO case. The insurance attorney served as liaison between the board and the CHRO, answered all the questions posed, and provided all the necessary information. For this reason, I objected to the presence of the superintendent in the executive sessions. No one should have presumed that she had something to offer in the third session because she didn't have anything to offer in the first two. Shortly after we issued the complaint, a representative from the Freedom of Information Commission presented an informational session to our board and clarified the limitations imposed on superintendent's attendance during executive sessions. There is no need for the clairvoyance these attorneys suggest. If the executive discussion generates questions needing answers, simply call or text them or ask them to join the session from wherever they're waiting. Under the statute regarding superintendents, our school falls short of meeting one with only one school, 1,600 residents, and 70 students. But we have one, and he is not elected, appointed, or ex officio member of our board and should not be granted a privilege not extended to the general public. If this decision is dismissed, boards of education are no longer mandated to follow the letter of the law. If indeed the decision presents such an enormous problem, then a legislative change in the statute to stipulate that the provision on limiting attendance during executive session does not include superintendents is in order. In the meantime, we implore the commission to uphold the hearing of the officer's decision and the law. I'm sorry that Shipman and Goodwin have been given bad advice to the Board of Education and the State of Connecticut. They should also follow and comply with the law. I also favor informed governmental decision making. Thank you.
May I make one response?
Attorney Moody, sure.
Please consider the practical reality. Complainant says that the board can always just ask the superintendent to come in and come out. Well, who brings the superintendent up to date as to what was discussed in executive session? When does that happen? How does the superintendent know how best to answer if the superintendent hasn't heard the discussion. So we do believe that the suggestion by complainants that superintendents can be on call, can be called in, and then sent back out is completely impractical. Thank you.
Do any of the commissioners have any questions?
I'd like to hear from Attorney Harlan.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Harlan.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Attorney Felicia Harmon. I was the hearing officer in this case. Do you want to just go through my reasoning?
Or, sure.
Okay. So,
thank you.
You know, this is not a landmark decision. This commission operates pursuant to statute, and the statute that controls the analysis in this case is very clear and very restrictive. 1-231A is one sentence that says twice, shall be limited. It says, at an executive session of a public agency, attendance shall be limited to members of said body and persons invited by said body to present testimony or opinion pertinent to the matters before said body, provided that such person's attendance shall be limited to the period for which their presence is necessary to present such testimony or opinion. I have two post-hearing briefs here, one from the respondents and one from the amicus. And in both of those briefs, the principal argument seems to be that the hearing officer is reading the provisions of 1-231A too restrictively. However, neither brief cites the statute that controls the analysis in this case, which is the statute that I just read to you. The amicus brief doesn't even dispute the finding that the superintendent is not a member of the board. This is a very restrictive statute that gives permission, limited permission, for people to go into executive session. The other principal argument that I'm hearing in this case is that superintendents are different and superintendents are special. That may be true, but that's a policy argument that seeks an exception to the express language of the statute that controls the analysis in this case. And that argument should be raised to the legislature. If this commission is prepared to say superintendents are different and superintendents are special, they better be prepared to say this same reasoning with regard to boards of police commissioners who'd love their chief to come in. They're pretty special and different. Town councils would probably like the mayor in there. You just ruled on a case where the argument was this person who was not a member was a liaison from one committee to the middle school building committee, and so she had special knowledge and should have been allowed to be present. That's not what the statute says. The case that was just decided shows how we're going to be hearing these arguments about people are different and special and they should be allowed into executive session. The one final argument that is raised in the briefs that really demonstrates, I think, a misunderstanding of the restrictive nature of 1-231A in the respondent's brief, they say, would this be a different case if, after listening to the report of the insurance counsel, the superintendent nodded her head and said, I agree? And in the amicus brief, they say, would the outcome of this case be different if the superintendent had expressed agreement with insurance counsel? This is not the case that I am deciding to read the statute restrictively. The statute is restrictive. Attendance of individuals in executive session who are not members of the public agency is limited to giving testimony or opinion. What the parties here, the respondents and the amicus, is arguing for is a decision that says superintendents can simply attend any and all executive sessions of the Board of Education. That is not permitted by that strict language that controls the analysis that this commission is is here to enforce. We don't, this is a policy argument. And I think that it may be well heard over at the legislature, but we have to enforce the provisions of 1-231 as they are written. And to say that agencies have to be clairvoyant, I think is a really a misrepresentation. All agencies who go into an executive session have to go in and ask people in as they see fit to hear from them. This commission has found that people who have actually given testimony and opinion and then who lingered in there, that was a violation. So to say that, how are we supposed to know? How is any agency supposed to know? You have your people that you think you may need outside, and when you need to hear from them, you invite them in. I mean, it's so interesting to me that neither brief cites the statute that controls in this case, because the language is so restrictive. This commission can't get around it. If they want a fix, they can get a fix from the legislature, but the commission does not operate other than through the statutes that the legislature has enacted. That's all I have.
Attorney Harmon, if the witness was invited, or the superintendent was invited to come in to give testimony, but did not give testimony, would that be a violation?
Yes, you have to be asked in to give your opinion or answer questions. As I was trained, executive session is not a spectator sport. The public agency is permitted to go outside of a public meeting. If they need to hear from someone, they invite them in. All agencies have to work with this rule that is clearly set forth in Connecticut General Statute 1-231A. Attendance has to be limited to the period of time for which their presence is necessary to present testimony or opinion, and then out they go. That's the rule we have. And to say that superintendents are different and special, you know, maybe they can get that exception to the superintendent over at the legislature, but again, you know, you just heard a case where the argument was this person was not a member of the middle school building committee, but she was a liaison to such committee. And the hearing officer said, you can't go in and not give testimony or opinion. You just decided this case. It's the same case. You can't go in and just kind of observe. And the argument that if the superintendent had said yes or said I agree really misunderstands the restrictive nature of 1-231A. You go in to give your opinion, you go in to answer questions, and then out you go. That's the rule. I'm not overly reading it overly restrictively, but it's interesting to me that the language that is controlling here is not mentioned in the briefs. The superintendent is not a member. She can only go in to give opinion or testimony. And if she's not going to have an opinion or testimony, she's not allowed in under the law as it exists right now.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hankins. Yes, Commissioner Hankins. Attorney Harmon, how did you come to find the fact in paragraph 9?
I asked the superintendent, did you have any opinion or testimony that you offered while you were in there? The answer was no. I may have asked her twice. Did you say anything about, and it shouldn't be that she observes the whole discussion and then just says, I agree. That's not what the statute allows. But I asked her, did you present testimony or opinion during the executive session? And she said no.
And this is Commissioner Hankins again, and your reading of 1-231 parentheses A is what it says, is necessary to present such testimony or opinion that calls for an affirmative act on the person present?
Yes, you go in, and this happens all the time. I think the clairvoyance argument is a little, you know, overstated. Agencies have to maneuver the statute all the time. People are waiting in the hallway and say, oh, wait a minute, we might want to hear from so-and-so. We have a question, or we'd like to know their opinion on something. What they're asking for is like a rule that says superintendents can just kind of go in as one of the members. They're not a member. They can't go in. That's just the way the law is written right now, because the executive session is done in private, and it's very limited as to who can go in there. And I think the statute was very narrowly tailored to control this kind of people just kind of going in with the group. It's specific and it's restrictive, and it's what we have right now. So yes, I have to go in and give testimony or opinion. Long-winded answer.
Mr. Streeter.
Yeah, Commissioner Streeter. So, you know, I think both sides made good arguments. I think that, you know, the complainant, you know, hit on the head about citizen volunteers, and if they had asked for, you know, professional advice, that was the word, or testimony or opinion, you know, then that would have allowed it. But, or even if they offered professional advice or opinion, I think that it seems that our jurisdiction is very limited in this case. I think that the hearing officer is correct in the interpretation. As much as I like to admit, because I mean, I've been, you know, on city councils and been a town administrator, town manager, and it's almost like a foregone fact that usually when I've been a town manager or town administrator, I go in on executive session because I'm the professional person. I am providing professional advice or testimony, but I'm not there just to, you know, witness the activities or something. I can totally see why the superintendents of the school boards would want this, but I think there is a remedy for this, which is to go to the legislature and have the language changed in 231A. Mike.
Yeah, this is Commissioner Hankins.
Commissioner Hankins.
I mean, the statutes regarding, you know, executive session 1-200(6) and 1-231(8), you know, created a tangled procedural thicket. It's really easy to trip up on. You know, we had the case before this with the executive decision, you know, technical violation. I had a case that I was the hearing officer on last time, Anita Erickalian. I found a technical violation of an executive session. But I think, you know, I agree with Commissioner Streeter that this is something for the legislature to deal with, and it's beyond our limits. However much I disagree with this, I agree with the decision. You know, it's correct, and Attorney Harmon was able to correctly, you know, parse out what was necessary to draft her decision. You know, I mean, I think that they should be there, but I'm not the lawmaker. You know, it is a minor technical violation, but Mr. Aurelio found it, I tell you, I've been involved in executive sessions for quite some time, and I don't think I would have picked up on it. But then again, it's me. I don't agree with the law, but I agree with Attorney Harmon, and I'm not here to agree or disagree with the law. I'm here just to follow it. So that's my opinion.
Commissioner
Pusashi. So I think it's a complicated question, but let me ask one factual hypothetical.
Sure.
So it says here, any person invited by said body to present testimony or opinion pertinent to matters before said body. So if I was, you know, on the board and I say, I would like the superintendent and X, maybe part of the board, part of the school system or not, to come in and listen to some of the discussion being presented by the insurance person and maybe specify some other reason and then help us share their reaction with us. Is that an okay request under these words?
I mean, it does get kind of tricky because...
How do you say, I'd like you to come in to do what? what is the subject of the invite?
You invite someone in when you need to hear from them. I mean, you can...
About
an issue that you're discussing in executive session. So I think allowing someone to come in and listen...
To make a comment, but...
Right. I mean, I think you can do it that way. Or you could, I think, more properly, call the person in and say, here's what we've said. We're thinking that, you know, we have to do this, we have to do that. What's your opinion on this? But I think it's not a spectator sport because of the way the statute is drafted, Commissioner Fusashi. the attendance shall be limited to the period for which their presence is necessary to present testimony or opinion. Now, could it be sometimes necessary for someone to hear some complicated? Perhaps. But the commission has historically, looked at the statute very narrowly. We found exemptions for people after having presented their testimony. They lingered in and listened to the rest of the discussion when they weren't necessary. We found violations for that. It's a slippery slope because everyone has people that are special and important that they would like in executive session. You just heard the previous case where that person was a liaison and they thought her expertise was going to be needed. It has to be needed. It has to be used. It can't be that someone just goes in and sits and listens. It's not allowed.
I'm hearing what. So, second question. Assuming the person comes in and assuming they're invited either according to my hypo or according to the more narrow hypo, whose job is it to say, now time to get out?
Well, after they say thank you for your opinion. Thank you.
Some member of the board.
Somebody has to tell her, thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
And whose mistake is it if that request is not made?
Well, I don't know.
If you don't tell the person to leave, the executive session runs on and you haven't ended the executive session correctly.
After the person gets done presenting their opinion or answering questions, you say, thank you so much for coming in. We're all set. And the person has to leave. This is how it works. I mean, someone has to tell the person that it's...
So it's the invitor that also has the responsibility of saying over. And if they forget to say or don't say over for whatever reason, the meeting becomes...
I think the troubling part...
Troubled thereafter because it ran beyond its...
I think the more troubling part for me, Commissioner Fusashi, is that the argument here isn't about what happened in this particular meeting. The argument here is broader than that. The argument here is that the superintendent, because she is special, because she is different, she should just be allowed to go in, even though I found, and they don't dispute, she is not a member of the board. This is a broader argument than this case. This is how we do things. This works for us. We like doing it this way. And I really don't, if it said, except for superintendents of schools, I'd be like, case dismissed, right? Because I'm just here to enforce the statute, right? But she is not a member of the board. If the board is akin to a board of directors and the superintendent is akin to the CEO, she is an executive administrator. She's not a member of that board. And an executive session, because it's done in private, because it is narrowly permitted for very few reasons, control, you can see the control in that statute that the legislature is, really letting us know. You go in, you give your opinion, and you leave executive session. So, I mean, it's one long sentence that says shall be limited twice.
Thank you. I hear your argument. Attorney Hartman, all in agent. Excuse me, Commissioner Goldstein. Wells, could a lawyer be invited in? Could legal counsel be invited
in? Sure. So legal counsel can go in when they have a written recommendation. Because, again, in 231B, which I don't have with me, but I think a lawyer can't just go in and kind of talk to their client, which to me, coming from private practice, seemed very like, whoa. So if the agency has a question, legal counsel can write a legal memorandum, and then that document will allow them to go in under 1206E, discussion of any matter that would result in the disclosure of a public record that's exempt. So basically that privileged legal advice written down is what will get them into executive session, but they can't go in without it unless they're called in to answer a particular question
counsel is allowed in under the same exception.
Legal counsel is allowed in to give legal advice when the legal advice is contained in a written memorandum. Again, very narrowly construed.
Well, but it's under section 1-231A?
No. It's under 1-206 subsection E.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think 1231B, from my memory, says that the lawyer has to have that written memorandum in order to get in there. Because it's, again, we're seeing the restrictiveness of the statute. You can't just go in and kick it with your client. You got to go in with a written memorandum to keep it all focused on that question for legal advice and that provision of legal advice. Again, very restrictive statute.
Thank you. Commissioner Goolsbee, well.
So I have a question for the respondents, because I just may have missed this, but complainant said something. Was the superintendent the actual respondent in the CHRO matter, meaning the discussion that was being had then would have implicated her or would have involved her because that's what was being discussed in executive session?
I do not recall, no, but I know that at previous executive sessions, and I wanted to clarify this, she wasn't just invited in to watch what was going on. In previous executive sessions, she had spoken to what was occurring during the CHRO proceedings because the board members were not there. So it was insurance counsel and the superintendent were both invited in to this executive session on June 28th because the board anticipated that she would be providing opinion or testimony. What happened, I think this goes to what Commissioner Hankins maybe had said, was that ultimately insurance counsel ended up choosing to answer the questions rather than the superintendent answering the questions that the board had presented regarding the proceedings. But the superintendent there wasn't there just to watch the discussion or watch what was going on. She was there because the board had previously asked her questions regarding the matter. They reasonably anticipated that she again would be answering questions regarding the CHRO proceeding, and therefore she was invited in with insurance counsel. Insurance counsel chose to take over the discussion and to begin the discussion with the board regarding what had occurred at the CHRO proceedings. But the superintendent, her purpose there was to also provide the testimony and to provide that opinion. Ultimately, insurance counsel, I guess you could say, covered everything that needed to be discussed, but the superintendent was there for that purpose, and the board anticipated that she was there for that purpose.
To clarify your question, I think you're asking...
Attorney Booth, and everything you just stated was entered into the record.
Yes, correct.
Let me finish. Sorry. And everything that you just stated was entered into the record before the hearing officer.
Yes, the board members, the two board members, Rose Bisson and Mary Ellen Donnelly, testified that the superintendent had spoken at two previous executive sessions and again testified that insurance counsel at the June 28th session was the individual that represented what had occurred at the CHR proceedings.
Thank you. Attorney Moore.
I believe you were asking if the superintendent was, as you might say, the accused. And we have no information to suggest that the superintendent was being accused personally of anything, rather she was representing the school board.
Usually matters are brought against the Board of Education and maybe an individual representative of the board, so if the superintendent had been named.
Okay.
That was one of my questions, because if you're discussing a matter where somebody is named in this particular litigation, would that then be a reason for them to be allowed in executive session, because what they're discussing about in terms of the pending litigation, it involves them personally?
This is Attorney Harmon. I received no testimony that the superintendent was the named party in the CHRO matter. The testimony that I heard was that she was the liaison between insurance counsel and the Board of Education.
If she was, would that make a difference? Would she be allowed then to participate in the executive session because that's what would be discussed?
Well, it could. So then we'd be in a different section, right? So we'd be in discussion, I guess we would could possibly be in 1206A, discussion concerning the appointment, employment performance, evaluation, health, or dismissal of a public officer. But still the same rules apply, you know, just for the time. She doesn't, so here's the key, I think, to all of this. Paragraph 12, right? Paragraph 12 says that it is found that why the provisions of Connecticut General Statute 10-157 provide the superintendent with executive authority over the school system and refer to her as the chief executive officer of the board, such statutory provisions do not provide that the superintendent, because of such authority or title, is a member of the Board of Education. And in the amicus brief, they cite my paragraph 12, and they say, CABE and CAPS do not dispute the observation that superintendents are not members of boards of education. That's it, right? That's it. You're not a member, your attendance is limited. I have the suspicion that many boards of education operate this way. And, you know, we only hear about it because it's a private, you know, behind closed door meeting. We only hear about it when a member of that executive session brings it to our attention. But I think the commission needs to be clear about what 1-231A says and how restrictive the legislature has made this. What we don't hear about, we don't hear about, but when we hear about it, we need to be clear, like you were in the previous case you just decided. The idea that you may have something to say is not a reason to be in there. You brought in to say something, and then when they're done hearing from you, you need to leave the executive session. That's the rule. When the rule changes, I'll be the first one to dismiss the case.
And this is just going to go through those, just so I wanted to finish my point. But so with that said, then I would agree with the way the decision at least is written in terms of that. I think it's a narrow construction. It does seem odd to have somebody who is a chief executive officer to be left out of executive session. And that may be something that has to then be changed. But then one final question is, in executive session, even on the actual agenda itself, it never specifies the specifics because it's executive session. It will say executive session to discuss this matter or that matter. So is there any leeway for a specific agenda item within the executive session itself to be listed so that that person can stay? Or is it always this verbal, you can come in, you can come out kind of thing? Because as you suggested, there probably are many violations potentially because people are not clear. So for the record, is there anything that gives them a better understanding of what they should or should not do?
Well, there's no requirement to list. I heard this argument from the respondents at the hearing that, you know, how will we know? You know, how will we know? We have to list who we're going to be inviting into the executive session on the agenda. That's not true. That's why in 1231A, again, you know, if you think you're going to need to hear from someone, they're outside the room. And if they don't get called in, then the minutes don't reflect that they came in. But if they do get called in, the requirement is that the minutes reflect that they came in. So you could potentially have five people in the hallway and call in three. And because you don't know if you're going to need them until you start the discussion, they're out there. And if you call them in, the minutes must reflect, you know, Commissioner Goolsbee Wells was called in, and she exited, and Commissioner Streeter was called in. And the minutes will reflect who came in because you don't always know. But that's how all public agencies have to kind of maneuver this requirement. You have to ask people in. You know, this commission has found violations for inviting two people in at once, you know, because you know, you can't, you know, their presence together wasn't necessary. One shouldn't have been listening to the opinion or testimony of the other. We've been very restrictive with interpreting this, and that's what you do, and that's why you don't know, and that's why your agenda does not have to list who you're going to be invited in. You just have to kind of give the general subject of what the executive session is about.
Thank you.
It's a fair deal.
Thank you.
I'm okay. You're okay. Okay. Does anybody else wish to be heard?
Could yes. I just, I don't want to prolong really good arguments all around, but if this is a problem, it would be a problem since I think the enactment of the FOI Act, this provision has been in there. There was an expansion, I believe, for the situation with the lawyer, which you brought up, Mr. Chairman, but it was, you know, specifically done so that there had to be a record of what was going to be discussed by the lawyer in the executive session. And one thing, just listening to all the arguments, I thought about the converse. If you were going to accept that the chief executive officer is like a member or something and should be in on these executive sessions, so then would the converse be true that the superintendent then has an automatic right to be in every executive session? Because you've just said that they're the chief executive officer and they have a certain kind of standing. So could that person just barrel into an executive session potentially where they're not welcomed, or, you know, the board doesn't think that they want them there? So I think if you open up the door, you might be opening up the door to that as an added consequence. But there has been some reference too to a couple of cases in the past where the commission maybe was a little bit more flexible in reading this. I think I don't have the command of the facts of those cases, you know, at my fingertips, but I think there may have been one or two cases standing against a lot of cases where we've had this restrictive reading, but where we've said, you know, this was a unique executive session, the testimony or opinion was interspersed throughout, and it would have been very hard for the agency to kick them out, bring them back in, kick them out, bring them back in. And so I think we've got maybe one or two cases where we accepted that and under an unusual fact pattern. So it's not something that we do all the time. I get the sense maybe that's what's happened out there in the real world, is that there's been a relaxation of these rules. You know, without looking at the strict language as the hearing officer cited to earlier. So this has been in the statute, I think, since the beginning of the act.
Just briefly.
Commissioner Street.
Yeah, Commissioner Street. I've heard a lot of good things from my fellow commissioners. I just want to mention that I've mentioned that my current profession, but prior to that, I did serve, you know, I was a, you know, citizen volunteer myself. I served like for 20 years. I was a two-term mayor. So I've been on the other side where we had the town, you know, manager. And I know that, you know, the board had similar, you know, their superintendent would come in. But they were, there was such a dominant personality, you couldn't stop them from giving their opinion or advice. So they were always in there doing that anyway. But I could see, you know, that there, you know, that this is, you know, this is the way it was, and there's probably that town of South Windsor probably violated the provisions in this regard. But I think that knowing now what the law is, that really echoing my earlier comment, it's probably, you know, something that needs to be looked at the legislature if there's any mechanism to remedy this. So thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? All right. I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the hearing officer.
Commissioner Hackett, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? It's a very interesting issue. I think it was well argued. I think the decision was well written. I understand Attorney Harmon's position on the law, and I think she's accurate. I'm going to vote in favor of this. Any further discussion? All right, hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Fusesci?
Yes.
Commissioner Goldsby Wells?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you all. Thank you. Very enlightening.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you.
We have a lot more.
We have to do item number 3, which is a motion for stay.
Okay.
On the amended
and
updated agenda.
Okay.
Not for you.
We're taking another break.
Can we go through it? We can go.
Okay.
Okay. So item 3 is consideration of motion for stay dated May 14th, filed by the Commissioner of Energy and Environmental Protection et al. In docket number 2023-0259, Gene Ferrazzelli versus Commissioner State of Connecticut. Department of Energy and Environmental Protection et al. So this matter, 2023-0259, was decided by the commission either the last meeting or the one prior to that. So just to back up, our decisions are not stayed unless they are done so either by the commission or the court. Typically, we don't see motions like this for stay. Typically, the respondent or the plaintiff will file a motion for stay in court. Occasionally we'll get this from an entity to try to cushion the time period that they have, that the decision is outstanding from the time the decision's outstanding to the time that they file their appeal. Bottom line, I don't think this as a practical matter makes much of a distinction. If we were to grant this, I would recommend that you grant the motion for stay just up until the time the court can rule on a motion for stay if an appeal is filed. We would not be extending the appeal period. We would just be saying that we're staying our decision until that time. Also, in this particular case, the hearing officer and the commission adopted a 60-day, I think, period for compliance with the decision. So the appeal would need to be filed before then anyway. But I'm guessing the plaintiff or the respondent is just concerned about this period in between the time they get their papers filed. So that's what I would recommend. I would recommend that we grant the motion just until a court can rule on the matter in the event an appeal is filed within the applicable time period.
Is there a motion?
Yeah, this is Commissioner Hankins. I would grant the motion to stay up until the time the court rules on the motion to stay in the Superior Court, and I would also just strongly urge and encourage the respondents to go back to court to enforce the earlier injunction. Okay, and you know, just give it a two front attack, as it were. But I would make the motion to grant the motion for stay.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I'll second the motion to grant motion for stay in FIC 2023-0259.
Any discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Fuzeschi?
Yes.
Mr. Goolsbee-Wells?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, O'Negan, yes. Passes unanimously.
Pending appeals, just one
new appeal, kind of different. So in docket number 2023-0468, City of Bridgeport, through its attorney, made an FOI request to the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. And as we, you know, as we went through the process of designating the parties, we originally designated the parties as, you know, Attorney Paul Testa, care of City of Bridgeport, because you know, the city didn't make the request, the attorney made the request for Bridgeport. And at the hearing, there was some argument about whether, you know, Bridgeport is a person under the act, and there was some briefing done. And pursuant to our regulations, you know, after the staff, who's designated by our executive director and general counsel, designates the parties, changing of the designation can be done by the hearing officer. So the hearing officer decided to substitute counsel as the complainant, counsel who made the request, counsel who filed the appeal, and the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities took an appeal from that procedural ruling. So it's very different, and we will be filing a response to their motion to stay the proceedings before the Commission very shortly. We don't usually see stuff like this happen, but you know, stay tuned. More to come.
All right, thanks, Alicia. Executive Director's report. I won't report on anything specifically today under staff reports. I'll just tell you that our two staff attorney positions are now posted. There should be maybe a couple of weeks left for that posting. And if we are able to secure two attorneys there, we will have a full complement of our staff, which will be terrific. Legislative report. I know Paula sent out the list of the priority bills, but we may want to wait. I don't know if you want to study that. Maybe we can chat about it next time, or Paula and Russell are here and we can talk about it if you'd like. I think we had a good end of session though.
We're available. If you want to have any questions, we could do it now or take it up at the next meeting?
Next meeting.
But the one
thing, that's a very helpful member. Thank you very much.
One thing we must say is that our chairman, his nomination went through 11:06 or something
thank
like
you.
That. So, that's all I have, unless somebody has new business.
Motion's made and seconded. Take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Fusashi?
Yes.
Mr. Goldsby Wells?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan? Yes. It passes unanimously. Thank you, everyone. It was great. It was a good argument. Yeah.
20 minutes to spare. All right.
Well, yeah.
Was that the deal?
I am 15.
You know.
No. A lot of people didn't show.
All right. We're working.